You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, October 16th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times, the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, from Huffington Post, Ryan Grimm. The story of Gary Webb and the CIA crack cocaine scandal story, which was much attacked back in the day. Also on the program today, WikiLeaks leaking documents of the TPP, particularly important, that's the Trans-Pacific Partnership, particularly important in light of the odds that Republicans will take over the Senate. One of the few things that you can definitely count on is that they will give the president fast-track authority to pass this horrible trade bill. Also on the program today, the Obama administration set to nominate a new ACL, or I should say a new nominee, an ACLU attorney for the Civil Rights Division, to head the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. And, of course, we'll also get to Fangate, where Rick Scott pulls quite a stunt at the beginning of his debate against Charlie Crist in Florida. And sound of St. Louis activist Lee Mavis dealing with police brutality and in and around Ferguson, confronts a cop on the phone who apparently has been harassing her by calling her place of work. All that and more on today's program. Let me say right up front, folks, I'm at 80% today. That's right. The people from Bob's Burgers were in town, and I got a late call to go out to dinner.
My buddy Sam Cedar and his little Hollywood glitterati crowd were out getting sauced.
That's right. Not sure what you said there, but it's true.
I think you know what I said. Maybe yeah, if you were professional and not sucking the IV fluid over there, you would have heard.
What were they in town for?
They were in town for a talk at the Paley Center, which I apparently was not invited to.
Oh.
Yeah.
Come on, where's Hugo?
Yeah, well, I was invited to Comic-Con in New York, but I couldn't make it because I was in Vegas. Folks, just a reminder, we're going to be moving offices rather quickly. Not a fully planned move, but what are you going to do? So any support you can give to this program is much appreciated, either by becoming a member of the program at jointhemajorityreport.com Or if you just want to go to majority.fm, hit the donate button at the bottom of the page. Your support keeps this program alive. We rely on it for 98-99% of our revenue. We cannot do this on a daily basis without you. So if you enjoy the program, you want it to continue, please help us out if you are in the position to do so. And as always, if you're not, just email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you want access to the second half of the show. By all means, we will not lock anybody out for financial reasons. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Ryan Grimm. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Huffington Post, Washington Bureau, head honcho, Ryan Grimm. Hello, Ryan.
How you doing, Sam?
I'm doing well. You know, it's I'm moving a little slow today for a Thursday. A little slower than I usually am on a Thursday, but aside from that, not so bad. Now, I haven't had a chance. I'm somewhat familiar with the Gary Webb story. I haven't had a chance to see either the documentary entitled Freeway Crack in the System, directed by Mark Levin, or Kill the Messenger, which is a biopic?
It's a Hollywood film, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. A little feature film.
But for those people who are not familiar with the story of Gary Webb, give us some background on this, because I don't know how shocked people will be by the CIA drug running at this point. But I think the story that people, I think, forget is the complicity of the mainstream media at the time, the way that they rallied around the in defense of the CIA.
Yeah. Gary Webb was he was really a kind of an old school investigative reporter, the kind that kind of comes up from, and it doesn't happen this way anymore, but he started out as an investigative reporter at a small paper in Kentucky, which the kind of position that doesn't exist anymore. He went from there to an investigative job in Cook County, Illinois, at another paper. And then from there, he went to San Jose, kind of the path that, radio DJs take, where they're trying to move up share across the country, and, they'll uproot themselves, to get an extra couple points. And so, by 1996, he was at San Jose and had been doing investigative journalism his entire career. He'd been nominated for several Pulitzers. He'd won two as part of a team, and he got a call from a source who was anonymous at the time, who I actually got to meet about a week ago, who said, "I saw a piece you did on asset forfeiture," which was way ahead of its time, for for him to be writing on asset forfeiture back in the mid-90s. And she said, I got an even better story for you. You know, she said, my boyfriend is in prison for drug dealing, and he was you know, working with the Contras and the CIA. You know, and so that, you know, so he followed that tip and ended up, you know, breaking a huge story in 96, in the summer of 96. Now, what he did that had been different, because the AP had reported on this in the 80s. John Kerry had put out, you know, hundreds of pages worth of documentation about all this. What he did that was different is he had two specific Nicaraguan importers, and he had one specific a Los Angeles wholesaler named Freeway Rick Ross. And so he brought it onto the streets. You know, what Kerry had done and what the AP had done is said, you know, the Contras are involved in drug running.
Right.
And it was kind of an abstract idea and also entirely believable. That's one of the biggest, you know, businesses in Nicaragua at the time. You know, why, you know, and they had clandestine flights going down to Nicaragua. Why wouldn't somebody put drugs going back up? I mean, it's just, you know, as a business decision, it's just what you would do. And obviously that happened. But what he did is he said these particular Nicaraguans, Norwin Meneses and Danilo Blandón, Norwin, by the way, his nickname was King of Drugs. And so the government...
That's not exactly the best moniker you want to have, your nickname, if you want to keep it on the down low, right?
I mean, El Rey de Drogas. And subsequently people said, well, you know, but the Contras didn't know, and the CIA didn't know that he was involved with drug running. It's like, well, first of all, you know, he had a long DEA file.
Now, wait a second. All right, so
hold on. Second of all, his name was the King of Drugs.
Well, let's... Yeah, but you know, you could qualify that prescription drugs,
right?
But wait a second. So let's just back up here for a moment, because you know, I remember those hearings from Kerry, and I think, you know, Kerry was pretty bold. I mean, that was something that was
great on that.
Very much to his credit back in those days.
You're the only one giving him. No one else was. There was no political upside to that.
No, there wasn't at all. It was a very bold thing for him to do at that time. And what was specifically the information that was out there? Just that, not just that the Contras were running drugs, because you know, that was a way to fund. But was it clear what the CIA's role was? And if so, what was that role prior to Gary Webb's series?
So, one of the problems is that it depends on what you mean by the CIA. You know, the CIA typically operates by contracting out to agents. You know, they will have an asset. Felix Rodriguez, for instance, you know, the Cuban exile who, you know, has been involved in everything from the Bay of Pigs to killing Che, to running the Contras spy operation. So is he CIA? Well, absolutely. He's paid by the CIA and he takes orders from the CIA. Enrique Bermudez was Gary Webb eventually tied to directly to Meneses and Blandón. He was paid and recruited by the CIA. He did not show up for work in Langley.
Right.
You know, and flash his CIA badge and, you know, live out in suburban Virginia. So were there people that lived in suburban Virginia and walked out to Langley and with their ID badge and who knew what Enrique Bermudez was doing? That's a different kind of question. What Kerry did find is that the CIA regularly got reports of Contra drug trafficking and never did anything about it. And in fact, the CIA in 81 or 82 managed to change the regulations on reporting drug trafficking. So just as they were ramping up with it used to be the case that if the CIA got information that somebody it knew or was involved with was running drugs, they had to alert the DEA, FBI, other folks like that. They got that law changed, and subsequently Kerry found that they did not alert any authorities. So it is a fact that they received many tips, quite credible ones, about drug running from the Contras, who were the CIA's army, and did nothing about it.
And we should be clear that when we're talking about drug running, we're obviously in trafficking. We're talking about bringing drugs into this country.
Right. Exactly.
And so. Did Gary Webb essentially flesh out just how involved and how much awareness there was with the CIA? It's one thing to say, hey, we're funding this group that is also engaged in criminal activity. It's another to say, we're not only funding this group that's engaged in criminal activity, we're actually giving them services in kind to engage in that,
right.
that activity.
And no, he didn't. And so, one thing that the media and the CIA beat him up for was he routinely would refer to the Contras as the CIA's army, which in fact they were. You know, the CIA founded and funded the Contras. You know, they would not exist if not for the CIA. And so, so Gary basically took the Contras as a proxy for the CIA, and he did not spend a ton of time investigating what particular people in Langley, knew about what its employees down in Nicaragua were doing. What he added to the conversation was that these particular Contras were bringing drugs to Los Angeles to this particular dealer who had been called the Walmart of crack cocaine. And so what it did is it tied what was an abstract idea that the Contras were shipping drugs into the U.S. to a particular, to the explosion of crack cocaine. And that's what the CIA and the media pushed back against. Their argument, if you would boil it down, would be like, okay, sure, some Contra folks were trading, we're bringing drugs into the country, but you can't blame the explosion of crack cocaine on this. It would have happened anyway. And these guys were keeping a lot of the profits, and there were lots of people involved with bringing coke into the country. And all that can be true. What Webb was saying is that, what did happen is that at the early stages of the crack boom, the Contras, these two particular Contras were bringing drugs in.
And the amazing thing about this story is how complicit, and not just how complicit, but how easily complicit the rest of the media seemed to be. There was recently a declassified piece coming out of, I guess, a declassified report coming out of the CIA. Entitled Managing a Nightmare, CIA Public Affairs in the Drug Conspiracy Story. And, well, before we get to that, actually, tell us that what happened. So Gary Webb puts this, produces this series, writes this series, it's published, then what happens?
So in short, this was mostly before the internet. I mean, this was San Jose Mercury News, so they actually put all the documents up online because they knew it was such an inflammatory charge. But there were fewer people online in 96. However, enough were, so people were emailing it around and reading it. It really took off, though, when Black Talk Radio started hitting on it, which, is still a powerful political network in the United States, and not one that is often thought about or talked about in inside the Beltway, but it's a powerful force, and it picked up Gary Webb's series, and it grew from there. And for the first couple weeks, it received an extremely sympathetic reception, and then the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the LA Times, even the Nation magazine, collectively came together to attack the series and to pick it apart. They had LA Times had a team called the Get Gary Webb team of like 19 reporters charged with undermining the story. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that informally they called themselves the Get Gary Webb team.
Wow. And what do we have a sense of
their mission? They said was to deprive him of a Pulitzer. That was how they kind of self-defined their mission.
So what motivated all of these different publications? I mean, you know, were those guys, was the Get Gary Webb team at the LA Times really just like, we don't want to be upstaged? How much of it was, we don't want to be upstaged? What were the different motivations involved here? You know, we don't want to be upstaged by some guy from the San Jose Mercury News.
Right.
Or is it also, there was just strategically placed reinforcement throughout the sort of the media, and then just the herd just stampeded?
Yeah. So all of them had some motivation of, jealousy and who's this guy from San Jose that's going to show us up. And that was strongest with the LA Times. How did you miss this story in LA and get scooped? And they had even previously profiled Rick Ross and called him, you know, the biggest dealer and the man most responsible for crack's explosion across the country than anybody else. And then when they came back to take him down, they were like, oh, Rick Ross, he was just a corner dealer. Like, what? 3 years ago when you profiled him, here's what you said about him. The Washington Post, they had an establishment issue. Walter Pincus led their coverage. He's extremely tight with the CIA, even was kind of worked for a CIA front group in the 60s or whatever it was before becoming a journalist. And that close connection enabled him to do some of the best reporting around weapons of mass destruction. He was really skeptical of that in 2003, but he was the leading voice in the Post newsroom, and he actually won an internal debate with Douglas Farah, who was the Central American correspondent and had confirmed a lot of what Gary Webb found. But he told me that Pincus beat him in an argument, and Pincus confirmed as much. You know, Pincus said, look, my sources were telling me that this wasn't true. His sources are CIA. New York Times had a very similar, it was in a similar position. You know, they don't want to be beaten by San Jose Mercury News either, but also they're very tight with the national security apparatus. That's where a lot of their sources are. And Gary Webb, in a lot of his interviews after the story came out, pushed his reporting really further than it was justified. And so he kind of set himself up. I think, they would have wiped him out no matter what. But amid the reaction to the story, he kind of fed into people who wanted to take the story further than it went, to say that the CIA did it on purpose and wanted to destroy the black community, or things like that that couldn't be backed up by the reporting.
Have you gone back? Has anybody? I'm curious about The Nation, for instance. I mean, because the Washington, Washington Post. Obviously, there's people there, well-placed people there who have relationships, sources, et cetera, and there's that dynamic of beat sweetening and all that. But I'm curious as to what the dynamic is at a place like The Nation. Is it just a way of saying? I mean, I wonder how much it was both a sense of like, well, we need to be taken seriously, so we've got to join in on this. We've got to jump on this this pig pile. And I wonder also how much it had to do with, it being the era of Bill Clinton.
So The Nation was it was driven by David Korn, and I think he'd be happy to talk about it. I think that'd be an interesting interview, to have to get him to reflect on it. Looking back, he did an excellent job of covering it in the late 80s when John Kerry was looking into it. He did some of the best reporting, so he was very familiar with it. When Webb broke it 6-7 years later, and I've talked to him about this. He felt like Webb went too far. Took his conclusions further than his reporting could justify, but I'd be curious what he thinks now that the documentaries coming out and the movies coming out. And one critical thing that I didn't mention in the last answer was the weight that the papers gave to the reaction of the black community. You know, I think it's hard for us to remember right now what the climate was like in white America back in 1996. You know, this was a couple years after the LA riots. This was, you know, shortly after the white opinion riot that followed the O.J. Simpson verdict. Crime was still pretty high. Drug war was in full effect, and you had a kind of racial tension and, quote, fear of a black planet, unquote, you know, that doesn't really exist today. And the Washington Post, in its editorial, one of its editorials about it, even had a line that said something like, more shocking than the allegations Webb made are the black community's response to them. And so, you know, there was a sense among the papers that they had to dismantle the Webb story to reduce the anger in the black community. So that you can't really talk about this whole story without bringing that dynamic into play.
Interesting. And so let's get to that recently declassified memo, Managing a Nightmare, CIA Public Affairs and the Drug Conspiracy Story. This is basically the CIA looking sort of contemporaneously. Was it a contemporaneous
mm-hmm. yeah,
account
yeah, this was,
of
yeah.
of what the implications of this Gary Webb story could be and what they were going to do about it, and then how shocked they were that they were that effective?
Yes, that's right. You know, they said, you know, we built up some good relationships with those in the media, and wow, this just really paid off. man, yeah. Putin could never hope to orchestrate something like the response to this story in a top-down way. You know, no, because you know, people don't believe them either. You know, the 1960s Pravda is not as credible as the combined weight of the free press, you know, the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post. You know, they couldn't have asked for anything more. On the other hand, in some major ways, they kind of lost the war. You know, I think if you ask most people, who who controls the House of Representatives, they don't know. But, you know, if you ask them, was the CIA involved in some drug running in the 1980s when it's the South American wars? I think most people would say yes.
Yeah, I wonder, though. I mean, I don't know if that's the war, really, for them, right? I mean, I think it's...
No, you're right. Yeah.
You look back on it, and it's just like history. And it doesn't...
Right.
I mean...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I wonder to what extent. I mean, it's obviously harder today because of the nature of our media landscape. I mean, much harder. But when you go back and you think that, like, you know, it wasn't this is a relatively new phenomenon. There was no Huffington Post in 2003.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There was no nothing
right.
outside of basically what was around in 96. And so when you see, it's hard for me to imagine that they just went like, holy cow, and I'm speaking to the CIA, holy cow, we really pulled that off. That's shocking. And they didn't say like, you know, this is going to be the model that we use in the future. And maybe for things like, hey, how can we get an invasion of Iraq if we're told that's what we need to gin up? I mean, you know, I wonder, my sense is probably that this is less effective, but I would imagine to a certain extent, this dynamic is still very much in place.
Sure. Although the CIA was.
And I don't want you to have to threaten
kind of
any relationships you have with the CIA, Ryan.
Right. They didn't love my last couple pieces, but that's okay. You know, so, but then, like I said, you know, CIA was not, they didn't want to go to war in Iraq. So that's a slightly different story. But yeah, I think it, you know, but then again, it, you know, it's kind of PR 101, you know, it just worked extremely well. You know, they built close relationships with people, and when it was needed, the people were there. And you know, they barely had to call in a favor because, like, for the reasons we laid out, they had their own, the media had their own motivations for going after him.
And so ultimately, what became of Gary Webb?
It's such a tragic story. His editor, who is now he's a dean of, I think, the LSU Journalism School. His editor wrote a piece that he said was not a retraction. It was, and it didn't refute any of the facts, but it was very self-critical about, you know, they had a logo on it that had the picture of the CIA. You know, it was, and so he wrote this kind of self-critical column, and the media, like the New York Times, put that on the front page, and he was given awards, and the narrative formed that the editor of the piece had, or the editor of the paper had, backed away from the story. He was sent out to some dustbin bureau, filed a grievance, and left the Mercury News and went to go work for an all-weekly. He went from an all-weekly to doing investigations for the California State Senate. He had long battled issues with depression, and what I was told, towards the end of his life, he couldn't afford, he lost his job, couldn't afford medication, and then he died of you know, what people say was, and I believe was a suicide in 2004. You know, a lot of the people that are close to the story don't you know, they think he was killed. I think that they didn't need to, nobody needed to kill him at that point because they had sufficiently destroyed him professionally. So that was 2004, and it's a shame that he's you know, not around to see kind of the resurrection of his work now.
Do you get the sense that within sort of journalistic circles, there's been a change in perception, or
I do. People from the Post and the Times have written to me recently, and other you know, significant folks in the media saying it's just horrible what, you know, what was done to him. Jesse Katz, who was the guy who led the assault for the L.A. Times, has since apologized and said that he regrets it more than anything he's done in his journalistic career.
Wow.
I think that the media is embarrassed at how they were able to find dozens of reporters to sick on trying to discredit line by line this guy's series, instead of taking the you know, taking it and trying to advance it, advance the story. Like, there was no integrity with how the media handled it.
Well, fascinating stuff, Ryan Grimm. Thanks for updating us. People can check out Ryan's piece on the Huffington Post. We will link to that at majority.fm. The documentary, which is out, is Freeway Crack in the System, and the major motion picture, Kill the Messenger, is in a theater near you, I guess. I never get out to theaters, so I have no idea. But I presume it is. Ryan, always a pleasure. Thanks, man.
You got it.
All right. Before we head into the fun half, we'll give you a little taste of what the fun half is like, folks. With this, isn't it an extended... And in the fun half, we've got, I should say, Ron Paul's ridiculous piece on how it would help us if there was no government and we had to deal with Ebola. We've got, oh gosh, we'll play that audio of the St. Louis activist. There was I get all sorts of stories here. Liberty, not government, is the key to containing Ebola.
I love that so much.
It's unbelievable. He's got the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. You know, when things like this come up, they must really panic, the libertarians. And I'll tell you something. So vacant, this piece that he wrote. So vacant. Stunning. We'll also talk about, we got a clip from Fox News talking about the, why we don't have a Surgeon General. They sort of leave out sort of they bury the lead a little bit with that one. But before we get to that, and we've also got some audio of Nikki Haley explaining, which we didn't get to yesterday, that there's no need to get rid of the Confederate flag in South Carolina. And she's got an interesting justification for it. But before we get to any of that, last night, Charlie Crist and Rick Scott were scheduled to have a debate. And I don't know what else to say other than this happened.
Tribune. And right now we want to take a shot of the stage here at Bailey Hall in Broward County. And as you can see, the two candidates who were invited to take part in this debate right now are not stepping up on the stage. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an extremely peculiar situation right now. We have Governor Charlie Crist. Florida Governor Rick Scott. Our incumbent governor and the Republican candidate for governor is also in the building. Governor Rick Scott, we have been told that Governor Scott will not be participating in this debate. Now, let me explain what this is all about. Governor Crist has asked to have a fan, a small fan, placed underneath his podium. The rules of the debate that I was shown by the Scott campaign say that there should be no fan. Somehow there is a fan there, and for that reason, ladies and gentlemen, I am being told that Governor Scott will not join us for this debate. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a debate. Rosemary Goodrow, I don't know, what can we say?
Well,
that's the ultimate pleading of the fifth I've ever heard in my life.
So there you have Charlie Crist saying that's the ultimate pleading of the fifth I've ever heard in my life. Of course, this is a reference to Rick Scott's pleading the fifth. I don't know how, like literally, I think hundreds of times in a testimony regarding the most massive Medicaid, I believe it was, fraud in the history of Florida, for which his company paid hundreds of millions in fines, I believe. And, you know, you get to plead the fifth sometimes before you get to be governor. So he says this, and they go on now to have a debate about whether or not the rules allowed for a fan to be placed in the podium.
What? Yeah, it is.
No, I'm not.
I'm sad the people
of
Florida aren't going
to
get to hear
we're not asking you a question. We're not asking a question of Governor Crist. I'm asking Rosemary about the situation that we have find ourselves in.
Governor Crist, do the rules of the debate say that there should be no fan?
Not that I'm aware of.
So the rules that the Scott campaign just showed us that says that no electronics can be used.
Are we really
going to
debate about a fan? Or are we going to talk about education and the environment and the future of our state? I mean, really.
Unbelievable. You know, for a guy who engaged in massive criminal fraud, Rick Scott sure is a stickler for the tiny rules. You know, the things like where you misreport who's paying what and what the services are getting, those you can let go. But when you start to let go of the little rules, you know, those electronic fans that they have.
What's wrong with these moderators? Now, come on, Chris. Is it true that Scott said no fans? Because if so, he's totally in the right for leaving us hanging on live television.
I'm actually just seeing. I'm just like, I would just like to say as we go into the conference room to engage in the massive fraud and fraudulent accounting practices to overbill hospitals and the Medicaid program nationally. Gloria from housekeeping has been really clear that she prefers that there's no eating in here. So I'd really like to just right. not.
That's right.
We can have water, no drinks that can sustain, and no food. Okay, let's go and defraud the government of $500 million.
I don't want to have to say this again, but there's some people in the room who have more than the quarter inch length hair on the side of their heads, and I think we're pretty explicit about how long the hair can be here.
We all know how I feel about hair on their heads.
Let's go.
There are serious issues facing our state, and it's like funding education appropriately, Frank, protecting our environment, making sure we have ethical, honest leadership.
Governor.
I mean, if he's going to give it to me, I'm going to take it.
This is not a platform for one candidate. We're hoping that Governor Scott will join us on the stage.
Well,
and I am told that Governor Scott will join us on the stage. In all fairness to Governor Scott, I was shown a copy of the rules that they showed me that said there would be no fans on the podium. And
they're my fans. Very strange.
My understanding is that Governor Scott will be coming out.
Not in my life, I'd imagine.
Frank, have you ever seen anything like this?
No, I haven't. This is remarkable over sort of a trivial issue, no matter which side you believe you're on.
Well, see, I love that now they have to make this like it's a trivial issue, no matter which side you're on. Well, one side is, who cares about the damn fan? Just do the debate, you children. And the other side is, no, I'm not going to come on because he's got a fan under his podium. Which side is real? I mean, can you
Well,
really?
Literally one side is saying it's a trivial issue.
Exactly.
That's like literally, it's like, it's a trivial issue now, regardless of whether you're the side that says it's a trivial issue or not.
With that said, I don't know what you do if you're one of those moderators, I guess. But, you know, I'm sorry. If you have a debate and only one guy shows up, you either just talk to that one guy, but if you think that guy is there somehow illicitly because there's air being blown on him by a device that is not an air conditioner, then you just say, okay, debate's over, we're walking away. But this is what happens.
Place in the awkward situation of having to decide this, and I don't think it's our role.
There it is.
He came out.
Now, let's hear Rick Scott's excuse as to why it took him, what, like 5 minutes, 6 minutes to walk out on stage after Charlie Crist had shown up for the debate. Here's the excuse.
And Governor Scott, why the delay in coming out over a fan?
I waited until we figured out if he was going to show up. He said he wasn't going to come to the debate. So why come out until he's ready?
What? Here's what Rick Scott should have done when he was asked that question.
Oh my God.
I plead the fifth.
Oh my God. That's the best thing ever.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program. Number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can support this program by buying your coffee from JustCoffee.coop. It's a fair trade coffee company. Everybody gets a fair wage all the way through. It's co-op owned, employee owned. Great coffee. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. We get a little kickback from that. And speaking of kickback, if you buy crap from Amazon, the least you can do is to make sure that we get a little kickback so that some of Jeff Bezos's cashola ends up in the Majority Report coffers. Just go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it. Whenever you buy something from Amazon, buy it through that link. You will notice no difference, but we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. Also, again, if you have the financial means to become a member, please do so. We need your support. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me now that I've turned on my IM. A little slow on the uptake today. Yeah, I ran into some scotch, and I'm not a scotch drinker.
Sam was very proud of himself. For having a little hangover. I like it.
Well, it's not just that I had a hangover.
You
went out.
Yourself.
I met these guys for dinner late.
Wow.
I got home super late, and then Saul woke me up at 5:30 this morning.
We get it, Sam. You're a cool dad. You still go out and have fun with your friends. We get it. We understand.
Yeah, we got it. The point is received. The irony is that last night I canceled my plans and went to bed at 9:30.
Wow.
Yeah. What time did you go to bed last night, Matt?
Probably like 2.
Oh, and Matt needs to say his wrestling memory.
All right, we'll do that.
Right up top on the
fun
app.
We'll do it right up top.
Okay.
We'll be right back after this.